From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Mexico is in turmoil following the peasant and Indian uprising in Chiapas and the assassination of the ruling party's presidential candidate. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with one of Mexico's most celebrated writers, Carlos Fuentes, about this crossroads in Mexican politics. Also, what motivates a gun lobbyist to work against laws intended to keep guns out of the hands of would-be criminals? We talk with Neil Knox, the former head of the NRA's lobbying arm. He now runs his own lobby group, the Firearms Coalition. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the recent work of the hottest young British actor, Hugh Grant. He's currently starring in three movies. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. Three United Nations peacekeepers from Belgium have been killed in Rwanda. A UN spokesman says there are more unconfirmed reports that other UN observers are missing in Kigali, Rwanda's capital. The Rwandan premier has been murdered, too. She was apparently near the presidential palace when she was killed. The UN is also saying there are reports the UN compound in Rwanda may have been attacked. The violence began yesterday when the presidents of Rwanda and Burundi were killed when their plane was shot down. Peace talks between the Bosnian government and the Bosnian Serbs have been postponed. The UN peacekeeping commander is working to create a plan that will bring both sides to the negotiating table. Peter Green reports from Sarajevo.
Spurred on by the Serbs' apparent willingness to suddenly talk peace, the UN commander, Lieutenant General Sir Michael Rose, is shuttling between the Serb and government commanders and hopes to draw up a peace proposal today. UN sources say the plan will call for a nationwide ceasefire, but the Muslims are reluctant to freeze the existing front lines, fearing that would award Serbs territory the Muslims may still be able to win back by force. After talks with the government, Rose appeared dispirited and warned his shuttle diplomacy is no substitute for a ceasefire. What we need is an immediate cessation of hostilities, followed by a peace process, Rose said. To work, any peace plan will also have to guarantee Muslim refugees they can safely return to homes now in Serb-held lands, decide whether Serb-held Bosnia becomes an independent state, and ultimately be policeable by UN troops. For National Public Radio, I'm Peter Green in Sarajevo.
The attorneys general of three states are threatening to sue the Department of Energy unless it acts quickly to find a permanent dump for nuclear fuel waste. Officials from Michigan, Minnesota, and Florida are meeting in Detroit today to develop a long-term strategy for handling radioactive waste. Doug Johnson of Michigan Public Radio reports.
The three attorneys general charged the federal government with not holding up the Nuclear Waste Policy Act, which mandated the Department of Energy to site a permanent nuclear waste dump by 1998. Recently, U.S. Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary suggested the earliest such a facility might open would be the year 2010. Michigan's Attorney General Frank Kelly says the federal inaction is causing a radioactive catastrophe in each of the 50 states.
If this were a space program to put a man on the moon, they would do it in 5 years. And yet they're taking 45 years just to put a hole in the ground to store nuclear waste. It's just unbelievable buck-passing.
Six additional states have sent representatives to Detroit and say they may join in any legal action that results from the meeting. For National Public Radio, I'm Doug Johnson reporting.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up almost 15 points at 3,694. Trading is heavy. The Nasdaq is up almost 4 at 754. This is NPR. The PLO says it regrets the car bombing yesterday in the Israeli town of Afula. 8 people were killed, including the car's driver. The Islamic extremist group Hamas has claimed responsibility for the attack. The United States says the regret is not enough. The Clinton administration wants PLO Chairman Yasser Arafat to condemn the attack. Meanwhile, the PLO is urging Israel to implement the peace accord as soon as possible. The organization says violence in the region, including the Hebron massacre in February, show the urgent need for the peace accord to be implemented at once. Paris and the surrounding region were totally paralyzed today by a transport strike. The shutdown caused massive traffic jams and forced thousands to walk to work. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
Almost all of the underground metro lines were closed, and only one bus in 10 was running. Paris also has an underground high-speed train network. Only a few of those lines were operating, and angry mobs tried to force their way onto the few trains that arrived. Every day, about 9 million people use public transport in Paris. Thousands had to walk through the rain to work today. Others drove their cars, creating huge traffic jams on highways outside Paris and inside the city. The transport workers are protesting a government report which they haven't even seen. They fear it will lead to job losses. The strike is the latest sign of growing social unrest in France, where unemployment has reached a record 12%. For National Public Radio, this is Lynn Terry in Paris.
Most of the trucking firms affected by the Teamsters strike are being told by the larger firms to negotiate separate agreements to end the walkout. The Teamsters union is striking 22 freight hauling firms. All but the biggest four companies can now bargain with the union. But of the 75,000 striking Teamsters, almost 70,000 of them work for the biggest four companies. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Carlos Fuentes, is perhaps Mexico's most celebrated writer. He says his country is bleeding at both extremes. At the beginning of the year, a peasant and Indian uprising began on the southern border in Chiapas. More recently, the presidential candidate of Mexico's ruling party was assassinated on the northern border in Tijuana. Fuentes says the solution to the violence at both extremes is democracy. Fuentes is an essayist and novelist. He was Mexico's ambassador to France from 1975 to 77. He now divides his time between Mexico City and London. His books include The Death of Artemio Cruz, Terra Nostra, and The Old Gringo. He has a new collection of short stories called The Orange Tree. Like many of his books, it's a fictionalized investigation into Mexican history. I ask Carlos Fuentes if he thinks Mexico is in the middle of a disturbing chapter of its history.
Yes, it is a very disturbing chapter. It's also a very promising chapter. The country has to change. We're at a crossroads. We have to bring our political institutions into line with our economic, social, and cultural life. It's an arduous process, and it's making the country shake, really.
When you say the country's at a crossroads, what are the choices that face it now?
The choices are trying to prolong an anachronistic political system or bringing it up to date, making the political institutions, I said, coincide with a very rich, varied, pluralistic economic, social, and cultural life. You can't go on having a prehistoric system when the country has become a modern nation in the best sense of the word, in the sense that it brings into the modern mainstream also its past, also the Indian and campesino communities, which have risen in Chiapas in order to be considered a part of the nation and not the outcasts of the nation.
I'm interested in your interpretation of what's happened with the Zapatistas, especially yeah. since one of your books was a novel about the assassination of Zapata.
Yeah.
The Zapatistas appropriated their name from Zapata. Do you think that they've been operating in his spirit?
I think they have. They're speaking of the name of an unfinished revolution. The Mexican Revolution, which did change a lot of things in Mexico, did not reach the state of Chiapas. Pancho Villa and Emiliano Zapata never rode in Chiapas. They're riding now. And the demands, the delayed demands of campesinos and Indians in Mexico that Villa and Zapata fought for have now been taken up by the Zapatista army in Chiapas and by Subcomandante Marcos.
Chiapas is the poorest and most southern region in Mexico. What do the Zapatistas want?
They want to be taken into account. They want democracy. They want to be able to elect their own leaders. They want to be able to elect their deputies, their aldermen, their mayors, their senators, instead of having them sent from Mexico City, imposed upon them by the PRI, the Party of Revolutionary Institutions, the ruling party in Mexico, and then having representatives that are truly in cahoots with the cattle owners, the big landowners, the mill owners who exploit the land and the people of Chiapas. They want to elect people they know, people they trust. So democracy is at the center of this rebellion.
Have the elections in Chiapas been a sham?
Always, always.
Maybe you can give us just a short history lesson on who Zapata was and how you see him tying into what's been happening now.
Zapata was a peasant, an agrarian leader from south central Mexico, the state of Morelos. He was a peon who had been living under the hacienda system, he and his family, and who yet had a dream. They had a dream of recovering their lands, of recovering their forests, of recovering their waters. These had been granted to them, to their villages, to their people, by the King of Spain in the 16th century. Their most treasured possession was the papers that granted them the right to the land, the waters, and the woods. So they rose in arms to regain these lands. And their whole struggle was in that sense. As long as they did not have the lands, they continued to fight until Zapata fell in 1919 in an ambush in the hacienda of Chinameca. But the people never believe that Zapata died. It is one of the articles of faith of the people of Morelos. You interview young people, old people. They'll say it is not true. Zapata never died. Well, in a sense, he didn't die. And now he is riding in Chiapas.
Now, what's the connect? It seems that the Zapatista uprising started just after NAFTA was passed. Do you see a connection between the two?
Well, obviously, it's very interesting that the Zapatistas, who had been preparing their rebellion for many years, and the army knew it, and the government knew it, struck a deal with themselves in order not to be considered, I think, puppets of Ross Perot or something like that, and did not stage the rebellion until after the passage of NAFTA was assured and NAFTA was in the books, which was January 1st, 1994. That way they could not be accused of being anti-Mexican, of being moved by ultra-conservatives or anti-NAFTA forces in the United States, whatever. But at the same time, what is very curious about this is that the government knew that there was a Zapatista rebellion brewing, and they did nothing about it, because if they did, then Perot would have an argument saying, look at Mexico, it is a country that has a backward population, an exploited population, how are we joining this country? So there was a kind of gentleman's agreement, curiously, between the government and the rebels, as far as we can see, so that the rebellion started punctually and courteously on time on January 1st, 1994.
What do the Zapatistas fear the impact of NAFTA will be?
They fear that they will become totally marginalized, that they will become irrelevant in the global integration scheme of things. I think they have been very intelligent, very intuitive about not being left outside. They would rather be, in a way, exploited than marginalized. So the rebellion also has that sense.
You've written that you deplore the violence of the guerrilla war waged by peasants and Indians, but that their desperation is understandable.
Yeah.
Can I ask you to elaborate on both of those feelings?
Listen, many of us, writers, intellectuals, statesmen, politicians, have been insisting on these reforms, criticizing the lack of reforms, pointing the finger at the tremendous plight of the Indian and campesino population in Mexico, a country of 83 million people, where at least 40 million live in poverty and 17 million in outright distress. We achieved nothing. We achieved nothing. Instead, the Zapatistas, by rising in arms, immediately achieved results, negotiations, concessions from the government. So what can you say about this?
You earlier described this, a few weeks or months ago, described it as the first post-Cold War revolution.
Yeah.
You still see it that way?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. It is the revolution of the marginalized who, after the Cold War, know that they can no longer be accused of being Marxists, communists, of serving the Soviet Union or Cuba or whoever. It is a post-communist rebellion in the sense that it calls attention to concrete social problems, to concrete social and economic problems that can no longer be blamed on one of the sides of the Cold War. Listen, when Henry Kissinger admits that the Zapatistas are right in the rebellion, what can you say? You cannot longer go to the rationale of the Cold War and say any movement towards social justice, towards social reform, is automatically seen by the United States as a pro-communist, pro-Havana, or pro-Moscow movement. This is over, and that's a very healthy development.
My guest is Carlos Fuentes, and he has a new collection of stories called The Orange Tree. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is perhaps Mexico's leading writer, Carlos Fuentes, and his new book is a collection of stories called The Orange Tree. He's also been writing a lot about recent events in Mexico. Recently, the pre-party, the ruling party's candidate, was assassinated. Does this throw the August election into complete havoc? I know a successor has been picked, but is there less faith in the election now, or what?
Well, we have to review the whole process. The Chiapas Rebellion assured that the government, for the first time, sat down with the opposition parties in January and decided on an agenda to fulfill long-standing democratic demands in Mexico. The first of all, to be sure that the electoral process, the electoral authorities, were independent of the government. You cannot believe in an election in Mexico when it is governed, it is organized by the government and the ruling party, the PRI. So for the first time, and thanks to Chiapas, you had this agreement which Luis Donaldo Colosio signed. And then he himself went on to promote a climate of democratic reform, forms of greater and greater freedom for the electoral process, which probably, I say probably, cost him his life. I don't know. But the assassination killed a hope in Mexico. Colosio was evolving very quickly. He was becoming a very strong candidate for democratic reform. And this is being cut down. And the country is in great pain and great doubt about what follows. The PRI has not helped. The statutes of the PRI, Article 159 of the statutes, state that in the case of death or incapacitation of its candidate, it will convoke a convention to choose a successor, a convention in which all the currents of the party should manifest themselves. This did not happen. Once more, we assisted to the rather depressing procedure of the president pointing his finger at one person and naming him the candidate of the party. I think Zedillo is a weak candidate. We need a political personality. We need a stronger opposition. So right now there is a shadow thrown on the whole electoral process because the PRI violated its own democratic procedures and instead went the authoritarian way once more.
What are some of the theories that are circulating now about why Luis Colosio was assassinated?
Listen, I know there is a conspiracy. I know there is a conspiracy. We all know it now. When you have seven people implicated, when you have filmed the death of Caesar, actually, it's like something out of Shakespeare, you know. You see them huddled together, preparing, and then assassinating the man. But beyond that, I refuse to go into speculation of conspiracies when I do not have any proof. I'm sorry, I can't do that.
The pre-party has been in power in Mexico since it was formed in 1929. What do you think its track record has been in ruling the country?
The PRI came out of a very violent revolution. The Mexican Revolution between 1910 and 1920 claimed 1 million lives. It meant an incalculable loss of wealth in the country. And it degenerated into a fight between military leaders, between military factions. The purpose of the founding of the PRI, what was then the PNR, the National Revolutionary Party, was to bring together all these factions and pass from the violent revolution to the institutional revolution, a government of institutions, which the PRI achieved. It did promote in its reformist phase public education, communications, the building of an infrastructure, the agrarian reform, the recovery of national wealth, especially oil. And the country was grateful. It accepted the bargain the PRI offered, which was, we give you economic development and political stability, and instead you give us your votes, and we postpone democracy for a later date. This began to crumble in 1968, when the government was faced with their first rebellion of young middle-class students, who wanted democracy, who wanted what the revolution had been teaching for all these years, which was liberty, democracy, justice. They said, okay, you talk about it, now we want it. The government's response was massacre at Tlatelolco. Ever since then, the government has not recovered from its fatal mistake of the shootings at Tlatelolco. It has tried to repair the system through the Echeverría, López Portillo, de la Madrid governments and the Salinas government. Basically, they have been preoccupied with saving the system. Now it has become a question of saving the country. And the country can only be saved through an open, modern democracy. There is no other way. This is now the choice for Mexico, and you cannot go back and you cannot substitute it with adhesive tape.
I'm glad you explained how the party went from fighting revolution to forming what they hoped would be revolutionary institutions, because the party is called, PRI stands for the Institutional Revolutionary Party.
Yeah.
I really never understood what was meant by that expression.
It is meant that revolutions create institutions, or there are no revolutions at all. If you have revolutions in Central America, in El Salvador, and in Nicaragua, the purpose has been to create institutions where there were none. This has to be understood. The American Revolution created institutions. It was an institutional revolution as well. The fight of Washington and Jefferson and Franklin was to create the institutions that have ruled this country ever since.
You have been dividing your time between London and Mexico. And where in Mexico are you living?
In Mexico City.
And has there been any direct impact of the Chiapas uprising in Mexico City, or is it something you just read about in the papers?
No. There's an enormous commotion in the country. Listen, I'll tell you something. The opera I Lombardi, I think it was one of the Verdi operas that has this theme of uprising and rebellion and brotherhood, was being sung at the Bellas Artes Theater in Mexico about 3 weeks ago. And when the chorus came on rebellion and brotherhood, the whole theater rose and people started screaming Viva Zapata and Viva Chiapas and hugging each other and crying. I mean, it is something that has caused real commotion throughout the society. We're on the brink of a big change in Mexico. Either we go forward or we really are going to have tragic consequences.
You have been writing fiction steeped in history, in Mexican history, for many years. Why, as a fiction writer, have you so often gone deep into Mexican history to tell stories rooted in the past?
We are reaching a new century and a new millennium, and we run the risk, there's always the risk in modern societies of falling into amnesia. And if you forget the past, you don't have a future. I'm very worried that we lose this sense of the past, of what we are, especially, you know, Terry, in a moment in which Mexico and Latin America is rapidly evolving from the concept of population to the concept of citizenship. More and more we're wondering who we are and less how many we are, which used to be our criteria. How many people in Latin America? No, today the question is, who are the people of Mexico? Who are the people of Latin America? And a way of understanding this is knowing the past, and the past shows us something very extraordinary, which is the cultural continuity of a country like Mexico, of a region like Latin America, and the lack of coincidence between the cultural wealth and continuity of Mexico and Latin America and the poverty of the political and economic solutions. We constantly ask ourselves, why the hell have our artists and writers been so imaginative and our politicians so unimaginative? We again have to bring this together.
Your new collection of stories, The Orange Tree, is, as we were talking about, rooted in the past. I want you to read a short excerpt of the first story, The Two Shores. And in each of these stories, you write first person through a voice from the distant past. Tell us whose voice you're writing in this story.
This is the voice of Jerónimo de Aguilar, who was the first translator for the conquistador Hernán Cortés. He was found in Yucatán as a shipwreck, who had become Indianized, had lived 8 years among the Indians, looked like an Indian, and became the first translator of Cortés. And he is writing from the lake of Mexico City, where he is dead after the fall of the Aztec capital to the Spaniards. And he tells us this: I just died of buboes, a horrible death, painful, incurable. a bouquet of plagues bestowed upon me by my own Indian brothers in exchange for the evils we Spaniards visited on them. I am shocked to see this city of Mexico populated by faces scarred by smallpox, as devastated as the causeways of the conquered city, all in the twinkling of an eye. The water of the lake heaves, boiling. The walls have contracted an incurable leprosy. The faces have forever lost their dark beauty, their perfect profile. For all time, Europe has marked the face of the New World, which in fact is older than the European face. Although, to tell the truth, from this Olympian vantage point death has given me, I see everything that's happened as a meeting of two old worlds, both millenarian. The stones we found here as are old as those of Egypt, and the destiny of all empires was written for all time on the wall at Balthasar's feast.
How does the United States look to you now from the vantage point of living in Mexico City? Is there still a lot of resentment there about American cultural imperialism?
No. I think soon you're going to start complaining about Mexican cultural imperialism.
Why?
Listen, because after all, we have a very strong culture. Mexico can organize an exhibition of 30 centuries of Mexican painting. You cannot. The United States cannot. There's a great presence. The American presence in Mexico is quite superficial. It is Kentucky Fried Chicken, Coca-Cola, which I'm having right now while I speak to you, and things like that, movies, etc. But there's also a deeper influence of the great American culture, of its poets, its novelists, its painters, musicians, etc. But when you compare this to the presence of 20 million people who speak Spanish in the United States and the strength of their family bonds, of religion, of the sense of solidarity, of cooking. You've read Like Water for Chocolate. The power of Mexican cuisine is so extraordinary in the face of this bland cuisine you have in the United States, this tasteless hash which you eat in this country. I mean, there is a cultural presence that is extremely strong, and maybe someday you'll start talking about Mexican cultural imperialism. And as a matter of fact, right now, if you go through the border states, you will find a wave of anti-Mexican xenophobia and even racism that is raging throughout all these states. So I think we have a far more stable and balanced attitude towards your culture than you have towards ours.
Carlos Fuentes, his new book of short stories is called The Orange Tree. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet the man who's been called the National Rifle Association's spiritual master. Neil Knox used to be the head of the NRA's lobbying arm. Now he runs his own gun lobby, the Firearms Coalition. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the work of British actor Hugh Grant. He's starring in three current films, Bitter Moon, Sirens, and Four Weddings and a Funeral. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. New Jersey has become the first state in the nation to mandate Holocaust education. Gene Dillard reports the bill was signed today by Governor Christy Whitman.
Starting in September, school districts in New Jersey will be required to include instruction on the Holocaust and other genocides in the curriculum of all elementary and secondary school students. Governor Whitman signed the legislation during ceremonies commemorating the Holocaust. She says the rise in hate speech and hate crimes, along with events in Bosnia, make the teaching of tolerance now imperative.
Our children and their children need to learn the truth about intolerance, to know that racial, religious, and ethnic hatred can lead to genocide. Unfortunately, too many of our children are not learning this history.
The governor says teachers will be asked to stress the personal responsibility of individuals to fight racism and hatred wherever and whenever they appear. For National Public Radio, I'm Gene Dillard in Trenton, New Jersey.
There's speculation over who President Clinton will choose as the successor to retiring Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. Leading the pool of candidates are Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell and Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt, although Babbitt reportedly doesn't want the job. Others include Federal Appeals Court Judge Richard Arnold of Arkansas, Federal Judge Stephen Breyer of Massachusetts, and Federal Judge Jose Cabranes of Connecticut. Russian President Boris Yeltsin's office is denying a controversial report that Moscow was planning to set up 30 military bases in the neighboring former Soviet republics. Latvia says Moscow's decision violates international law. The BBC's Robert Parsons reports from Moscow.
The dispute over President Yeltsin's decree is but the latest in a series of arguments between Moscow and the Baltic states over the presence of Russian troops in their countries. But on this occasion, there does seem to have been a misunderstanding. The decree confirmed Moscow's intention to keep about 30 military bases on former Soviet territory outside Russia's present borders. But according to a Russian Defense Ministry spokesman, it was not intended to suggest that Russia plans to set up new military bases in Latvia. The decree was meant to refer to countries within the CIS, which have agreed to the presence of Russian troops. That certainly wasn't the impression of the Latvian government, which on Wednesday responded to the decree by calling for the immediate withdrawal of Russia's remaining troops from Latvia.
Robert Parsons reporting. Authorities in Edison, New Jersey are testing a natural gas pipeline for leaks. They're pumping hundreds of thousands of gallons of water through the line at more than twice the normal pressure. There are no reports of problems. This test comes 2 weeks after a pipeline explosion leveled 8 apartment buildings above it. Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials gained 13.5 points to end the day at 3,693. This is NPR News. A public interest group charges the Forest Service is a corrupt agency that mismanages national forests. The Center for Public Integrity says, quote, "The Forest Service in general sleeps with the timber industry." The 81-page study criticizes the Clinton administration for failing to effectively reform the Agriculture Department agency. It also says the congressional agenda regarding national forests is set by timber industry interests. Administration officials have disputed the report's conclusions, but they say changes are underway at the Forest Service. The agency has a new director who took office just this year. The parent company of 7-Eleven stores is facing a $1 billion lawsuit from its franchisees. Melba Gomez of member station WBEZ reports.
The franchisees are accusing 7-Eleven's parent company of failing to live up to agreements to remodel stores, advertise, or provide other support services. The lawsuit filed on behalf of 2,800 franchisees contends Southland cut advertising and support after completing a leveraged buyout in 1987. The class action lawsuit filed in Chicago federal court names Southland and the Japanese firm which acquired the company in 1990. Five of the plaintiffs are from Illinois. Southland President Clark Matthews denies the accusations, saying, quote, "It's mind-boggling that anyone could conclude that the company has not supported its franchisees." Southland has over 14,000 7-Eleven and other convenience stores around the world. For National Public Radio, I'm Alba Gomez in Chicago.
A senior Russian disarmament official has been fired. He allegedly tried to develop a secret chemical weapon. President Boris Yeltsin's spokesman says the official was supposed to oversee the dismantling of the country's chemical weapons stockpile. The effort came to light after a scientist revealed the Russian chemical weapon program in 1992. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Here's a chilling statistic for you. Over the last 2 years, guns killed almost 70,000 Americans, more than the total of U.S. soldiers killed in the entire Vietnam War. This comes from the new book Lethal Passage about the gun crisis in America. We spoke with author Eric Larson in January. We thought you'd also be interested in hearing from someone who has dedicated his life to opposing gun control. Neil Knox is the former head of the National Rifle Association's political and lobbying arm. He's on the board of the NRA and since 1984 has run his own lobby group, the Firearms Coalition, in a suburb of Washington. In the Wall Street Journal, Larson described Knox as the NRA's spiritual master and said he's likely to have a greater impact on the fight over gun control than any other individual in America. Knox says gun control isn't the solution to crime because no gun law has succeeded in keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. But I pointed out that his group works against the passage of any gun control law with teeth.
We have been working against it because in the laboratory that is the states and the various gun laws that have been passed, we should be able to identify the kind of laws that have a positive effect in controlling crime. In fact, not one gun law can be identified as having had the stated desired result. The reason is that criminals pay no more attention to gun laws than they do the laws against rape, robbery, and murder. The only ones who obey the law are the law-abiding citizen. They're not the problem. But by disarming the citizen when the criminal is not disarmed, we have created a situation where the criminal has the advantage. Even if he didn't have a gun, he would have the advantage. A woman alone trying to raise her child is absolutely a victim to any strong man that decides that he's going to do anything he wants to with her.
Attorney General Janet Reno and many other people have said, we have to make sure it's at least as difficult to get a gun as it is to get a driver's license. Do you object to that?
I do. There is no constitutional right to drive a car. There is a constitutional right to keep and bear arms.
So that's it?
Well, I think that is enough said right there. There's all the difference in the world.
Well,
you do not.
Let me follow up on that. You have said that the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, is the most important amendment in the Bill of Rights.
I didn't say it was the most important. What I said was that it is the amendment that is in the Bill of Rights that gives muscle to the rest of the Bill of Rights. We have some wonderful words in the constitutions of various dictatorships, even in the constitution of the former Soviet Republic, had wonderful words about personal freedoms. And they meant nothing because the people were denied the means to protect themselves against an oppressive government. Stalin killed millions of people, and he had nothing to prevent him from doing it because only the crooks and the police had the guns.
So are you saying that the best way of stopping crime now is for citizens to arm themselves to protect themselves?
I'm not saying that's the best way. In fact, I find it appalling that we would have to even think in those terms. But since we live in a world where the criminals are armed, the criminals do not care about human life, either their own or other people, the people need to have the means to defend themselves. It astonishes me that the government, which admits that it cannot protect the people and is not under requirement, under law, to protect the people, only as society as a whole, not as an individual citizen. Since they can't protect me and they can't protect you, what business is it of such a government to say that we're going to deny you the means to defend yourself?
Do you use a gun for self-defense?
Thank goodness, I never have.
But do you carry one for self-defense?
No, I cannot because of the laws of Maryland and here in the District of Columbia. I cannot carry a gun because the laws disarm me, but I assure you that the criminals are carrying guns here. I have seen it by people that one night, I was not too many blocks from where we are, where I am right now, when a fellow stepped out of the shadows, I could see the gun in his rather thin pants. It was summer night. I could identify even the type of gun. There were three of us, and we stared him down. He decided to not do anything, but we were defenseless unless we could out-wrestle him because he had a gun. He was a criminal. But the law-abiding citizen is disarmed. If you take a gun away from a criminal, he is still a criminal. You take a gun away from a law-abiding citizen, and he is a potential victim, or she.
What would you carry if you could?
Oh, I would carry probably a relatively small gun so I wouldn't embarrass myself or my neighbors by rudely displaying the gun. I don't like the idea of doing this. More important than what I would carry, I think, is what a woman would carry, how she would carry it.
What would you recommend for me?
I would recommend for a woman a revolver. A 5 or 6 shot small frame revolver, mainly because the gun is capable of handling any type of ammunition without misfunctioning or malfunctioning. It is a very safe gun in the sense that it is not cocked. You have to roll a hammer back or pull the trigger, which requires a considerable effort. I find that that type of gun is probably the best for a woman to carry, and it has interested me to see how many women are beginning to obtain guns. I think it's probably the result of the fact that we have so many single women now who are not under the, quote, watchful care of a husband. Now they are depending upon themselves, they must depend upon themselves to protect themselves and their families. And so they are interested in the greater security which does come as a result of having a firearm with which to defend themselves.
One of the paradoxes here, I think, is that, I think more law-abiding citizens want to carry guns because so many criminals are carrying guns, and it's becoming so dangerous in the streets and dangerous at home and dangerous in the schools. Now, so a lot of people would argue that the reason why law-abiding citizens want to carry guns is because there aren't enough laws to prevent the criminals from carrying guns.
Oh, on the contrary.
And so if we prevented the criminals from carrying guns, the rest of us wouldn't have to worry about being armed.
It's already against the law for that criminal to carry a gun, against the law for him to possess a gun. Now,
But
see, the criminal is a criminal whether or not he's got a gun, and he is a danger to the community whether or not he has a gun. You, as a woman, are defenseless when you are faced with a large, hulking criminal. I don't care if he's armed with nothing but a pocket knife or only his fist. He's much more powerful than you are. And I say that you should have the right to be able to defend yourself. That is what the Second Amendment was intended to do, to provide protection for the individual, for the community that he lived in, and protection of his family. This is closer to the Second Amendment intent that the Founding Fathers had in mind, the idea of protection, because in those days there wasn't so much recreational shooting. As a man, my use of a firearm is primarily recreational. Of course, having a gun for self-defense is not a bit of fun. That's not sport. But at the same time, my recreation is not the reason that the Second Amendment is there. There's a bumper sticker that says that the Second Amendment ain't about duck hunting. This idea of a sporting purpose is nonsense. The Second Amendment is about personal defense and defense of community.
My guest is Neil Knox. He's on the board of the NRA and is the head of the Firearms Coalition. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Neil Knox, founder of the gun lobby group, the Firearms Coalition. How old were you when you got your first gun, and what was it?
At Christmas, when I was 9 years old, my dad gave me a .22 rifle. It was, of course, some years before I was able to take it out on my own. That was after a lot of training. But my wife also got her first gun when she was nine, the Christmas when she was nine. That's not unusual, but we were trained in both respect for the gun and respect for law. The problem we have today is people who are not trained in respect for either.
When you became more politicized in relation to guns, did the kind of guns you owned or the way you used the guns you owned change at all?
Not really, not mine. But in the case of, I shouldn't say not really as far as the guns I used, but the guns I owned did buy the kind of gun that was more useful for self-defense when my wife, after we'd been married about a year, I gave her a little .38 Special Smith & Wesson as Mother's Day present. And at the time we had one child. But it was for the purpose of providing her the means of a small gun with which she could defend herself.
Has she ever had to use it?
She has come very close. She had some very serious experiences where she came close to having to display the gun or maybe more. She never has used it. Both of my daughters, however, who I have given them guns as they, after training, when they grew up, both of my daughters have been in a situation where the gun did perhaps save them from injury, rape, or death.
Can you tell us about one of those instances?
Well, one night my daughter that lived here was alone with her two boys. And she was being stalked. And the police said, oh, you don't have to worry about that. They very seldom do anything. But unfortunately, my daughter knew better. She had a very good friend who was also stalked and had received a bunch of telephone calls and who wound up being killed by somebody that broke in the middle of the night. So my daughter was petrified. And she had the gun to defend herself. And this guy, apparently the same one, who broke in more than once into the house. One time he broke in, she heard him downstairs, and she informed him that she had a gun, and she intended to use it. He left. Now, if she had not had a gun, where would she have been? You think about the movie, that many movies we've made, like Dial M for Murder. There would be no plot. There would be nothing to write about if the woman, alone, helpless, had a means of defending herself.
I'm glad you brought up movies. I want to ask you about movies and television. As you know, there are a lot of people who would like to get Hollywood and the television industry to tone down violence and the use of guns in movies and TV shows. What do you think of that?
Well, I have mixed emotions. We do have a First Amendment, but I'm also aware that much of the criminal craving for firearms, if I can call it that, is spurred by the news media, or not the news media, the television media showing these exotic-looking guns, and they spray around and they show how tough the person is, and it causes some people that aren't quite, they don't have both oars in the water, that causes some of those people to want to emulate what they see on television. We know from 150 studies that violence on television does lead to violent behavior of kids. If you can sell soap on television, you can sell violence. And I'm afraid that's what's been going on here.
So you'd rather see some kind of restriction placed on the use of guns in TV and film than try to restrict criminals' access to guns?
I would like to. Well, first of all, bear in mind that access is already restricted.
Now that there's the Brady Bill, there's a criminal check.
No, has been since 1985 or 1968. They talk about Sarah Brady said we've got to take guns out of the hands of drug dealers. Now you think about that. That's a ludicrous statement. A 16-year-old kid waving around a gun already has a 5-year waiting period. He has had that since 1968. But that didn't prevent it, did it? See, the people who call for more gun laws very, very seldom know the laws that are on the books.
Well, I want to thank you for talking with us.
Terry, it's been my pleasure.
Neil Knox is on the board of the NRA and is the executive director of the gun lobby group, the Firearms Coalition. This is Fresh Air. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll be hearing the latest on the violence in the Central African nations of Rwanda and Burundi, two neighboring states whose presidents were both killed in a plane crash this week. Also, we'll be hearing more from Israel following the car bombing that claimed several lives in the Israeli town of Afula and some other Palestinian attacks. And today, condemnation of those attacks from the leadership of the PLO. Also, an interview Susan Stamberg will have with George C. Wolf, the director of the New York Shakespeare Theater and the successor to Joseph Papp, as well as letters from listeners on such subjects as ear mites, tattoos on earlobes, and big guns.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Suddenly, everywhere you look, you find the British actor Hugh Grant. You might have caught glimpses of him before in the Merchant Ivory movie Morris, or playing the part of Chopin in Impromptu, or as Lord Darlington's nephew in The Remains of the Day. But now he's in three movies at once: Roman Polanski's Bitter Moon, John Dygan's Sirens, and Mike Newell's Four Weddings and a Funeral. Film critic Stephen Schiff went to investigate.
He is going to be a big star. Hugh Grant has some of the stuff that another famous Grant, Cary, had before him. Great looks, a beguiling accent, and an air that's at once manly and pleasantly befuddled. Oh, and one more thing. He seems available. Easy, not hard to get. For my money, you can skip him in Sirens, a fairly dopey movie in which he plays a fuddy-duddy minister married to a fuddy-duddy wife, both of whom get sexually liberated when they meet a randy painter and his three fetching muses. In other words, the movie's structured like the most traditional of porn films. And like the most traditional of porn films, its main point is the ogling of naked women, principally the model Elle Macpherson, whose acting career will undoubtedly prove far shorter than her legs. The second Hugh Grant movie, Roman Polanski's Bitter Moon, is another matter. Once again, Grant plays a sexually repressed and very married fuddy-duddy. But this time he's on board an ocean liner, and he finds himself drawn to an exotic couple. A wheelchair-bound writer, played by Peter Coyote, and his lubricious wife, played by Emmanuel Seigner, who in real life is married to Polanski. Peter Coyote spends the movie telling the poor, sputtering Grant about his courtship and marriage to Emmanuel Seigner, all in flashback. And it's a tale full of nutty sex, S&M, and purple prose. If Coyote's voiceover narration is any evidence, he's a very bad writer indeed. Bitter Moon is some kind of crazy must-see, one of those howlingly awful movies that transfix you with their obsessiveness and silliness and occasional power. A midnight movie for the ages, maybe, but not the best platform for Hugh Grant. No, if you want to see what's good about Grant, you have to catch the British film Four Weddings and a Funeral. This movie is the sort of debonair romantic froth Cary Grant used to float through like an archangel. The kind of lovely, funny, and even touching stuff that Hollywood can't seem to make anymore, and that, before Four Weddings, I thought maybe no one could make anymore. The premise is simple. Grant is a young Londoner who's had 9 girlfriends in his life, but can't quite get it together to commit to any of them. In fact, he can't quite get anything together. He's late all the time, especially to the weddings that he and his friends seem to attend every few weeks or so. At one of these weddings, he spies a bewitching young American woman, played by Andie MacDowell, and the two of them wind up in bed together. But Grant can't commit to her either, and why should he after one night? Trouble is, the memory of her haunts him. And unfortunately, by the time he sees her again, at another wedding, she's with her brand new fiancé. Then, as her own wedding approaches and Grant sees her slipping from his grasp, he decides it's time to open his heart, which, under the circumstances, requires the verbal equivalent of the jaws of life.
I just wondered if by any chance, I mean, obviously not, because I am just some kid who's only slept with 9 people, but I just wondered, I really feel, in short, to recap in a slightly clearer version, in the words of David Cassidy, in fact, while he was still with the Partridge family, I think I love you. And I just wondered whether by any chance you wouldn't like to, No, of course not. I'm an idiot. He's not. Excellent, excellent. Fantastic. I'm so sorry. Lovely to see you. Sorry to disturb. Better get on.
That was very romantic.
Well, I thought it over a lot. You know, I wanted to get it just right.
Four Weddings and a Funeral isn't always as cuddly as it thinks it is, but most of the time it works like a dream. The director, Mike Newell, creates an intimate, bubbly atmosphere in which Grant and his posh London friends can toss off effortless one-liners at a speed that will remind you of Hollywood's screwball comedies of the 30s or of Noel Coward. And meanwhile, a star is being born. We have plenty of romantic young actors who can toss their hair and look sullen and dangerous. Hugh Grant reminds us that sometimes funny works even better.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. I'm Terry Gross.
This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next archive edition of Fresh Air, conversations with writers Grace Paley and Kurt Vonnegut. Paley has a new book collecting her 3 volumes of short stories. Vonnegut's novel, Slaughterhouse-5, has just been published in a new edition. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next archive edition of Fresh Air.